Honeybees have long been about as welcome in New York City as poisonous snakes. They were classified as wild and dangerous animals and banned by the city's Department of Health. That meant beekeepers had to go clandestine, keeping secret hives in backyards and gardens, on roofs. Now the agency has lifted its ban, and beekeepers are coming out of the closet. NPR's Margot Adler reports.
On a warm spring Sunday in Central Park, 110 people are sitting inside on chairs for 3 hours in a building next to the park zoo, listening to beekeeper Jim Fisher teaching them how to raise bees.
Yikes, I got stung. Well, you're a beekeeper. Expect it. You're going to get stung. Have you done worse things, stubbing your toe? Yes, you have.
This class started when beehives were still illegal in New York, but interest is now growing. People did get fined up to $2,000, and there were about a dozen complaints a year, but most hives weren't noticed. Take Deborah Gregg. She's the urban agriculture coordinator of East New York Farms. We're at a half-acre community garden that grows about 15,000 pounds of food a year in a very diverse and poor community in Brooklyn that is home to 180,000 people.
There's not a lot of access to good food in the neighborhood, very few grocery stores.
And the community, West Indians, Russians, Latinos, Bangladeshi, they want foods that aren't easily available, and they want local honey. Greg oversees two hives.
We've been keeping bees for about 6 years now, and we...
So you were keeping them even when they were illegal?
Yes.
When it was illegal, did you get into any trouble, or...?
No. I think part of that is because the folks in this community are particularly connected to their agricultural roots, and
they saw this as good.
I mean, how could honey not be good? I don't know. And we've actually... The only times that folks have gotten stung by bees in this garden have been by wasps, which aren't bees at all.
We get into our bee jackets with those veiled hoods. Jim Fisher, who taught that class and who runs the Gotham City Honey Co-op, is helping out.
Looks really active.
I know, they might even need more space already. I can't believe that.
How many bees are we talking about in a hive like this?
30 to 40,000 maybe, maximum.
And more to come as spring progresses. Greg has opened the hive, which looks a little like a file cabinet, and is cleaning it out. Then she removes one of the trays.
It's okay.
Investigating.
Yeah. But you can see that there's a nice patch of brood there on that one frame. And that means the queen is... There she is, right there. Bingo.
You got the queen?
Oh,
right there.
Did.
Oh, yeah.
Where's the queen?
We right there.
The queen?
Now, I have to admit, to me, she just looks like a slightly bigger bee.
Right there.
So they're following her.
Yeah,
around.
See, she's freaking. She's running. We disturbed her.
One hive can produce 100 to 150 pounds of honey. Fisher says with stories of bees dying out, once it was save the whales.
Now it's the bees. The bees have become the symbol of keeping the environment away from a path towards disaster. It's really not about the bees or the honey at all. It's about growing local food and the realization that you don't just put seeds in the ground and toss some water on them. It's a more complex process.
Translation, even in New York City, trees and plants need to be pollinated by bees. Back in that classroom, Fisher says although beekeeping is now legal, given panicky neighbors, stealth is often a wise course.
We paint beehives to look like rooftop air conditioning units. I have a little jacket that I wear when I go up on roofs. It says Al's Air Conditioning. There is no such company.
There's still a little bit of outlaw in New York City's beekeepers. Margot Adler, NPR News, New York.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. Whenever a producer and I travel out of Washington, D.C. to report a story for the show, we try to arrange what we call shopping opportunities. When we planned the trip to Austin, Texas for the South by Southwest Festival, we knew we would stop by Allen's Boots. We were not alone. The owners of the store consider the festival its second Christmas. We arrived after breakfast on a Thursday morning just as Allen's opened for business. Sean Greenberg, whose father Steve owns the store, shared some of the family history and described the store's journey from Dallas to Austin.
My grandfather has always been like a retail salesman He helped start Payless Shoes, but then he started his own shoe store in the Dallas area. Another competing shoe store moved in a few doors down, so to show him, my grandfather decided to start selling boots. He started a boot store in Dallas, and then my father worked for him, and then my father moved down here.
And set up the shop here.
Right.
And when was that?
1977.
1977. When he was in high school, Sean Greenberg says he rebelled against the whole idea of cowboy boots. But in college, he had a change of heart. Today, he is all about his most recent acquisition, Cayman Crocodile boots.
Awesome. And then I got this custom top.
Look at that boot. It's silver on the top, brown crocodile on the foot, and then it's got this wonderful kind of
collar.
Weave and collar. Is that what you call it at the top of the boot?
Yeah.
So did you have them custom made silver like that?
Yeah, like you can mix and match stuff. So
what would a customer have to pay for the boots that you're wearing?
I didn't even want to look at the price of these, but I think you'd be looking at about $1,300 or $1,400.
Allen's Boots is offering an even bigger ticket item right now, limited edition 125th anniversary boots by Lucchese. To mark the company founding, Allen's is selling 125 pairs for $12,500 per pair. Okay, so you don't have the deep pockets of some of the celebrities who've purchased boots here, actor Lawrence Fishburne and singer Trisha Yearwood, but you want a cowboy boot. We had Sean Greenberg explain what separates the cowboy boot from the other footwear.
Typically, when you say a cowboy boot, you're talking about a boot that's about 12 to 13 inches tall. It's got this V right here.
At the top where you put it in?
Exactly. The pull straps. And then a Western heel is going to be roughly like an inch and a quarter.
High.
With this slant on the back. This is a pointed toe, but there's also a round toe or a more square toe.
But if people are spending a lot of money for a boot like this, they want to get something that is going to fit and is going to last. Is there something unique to shopping for cowboy boots that's unlike shopping for shoes? I mean, do they have to be put on a certain way, fit a certain way?
Yes. It's a whole other world, really. The most important part of the boot, as far as fit goes, is right across the top of your foot.
Right.
Through the width.
Right.
And the big difference between boots, cowboy boots especially, and shoes is that your heel should move when you walk in a boot. It should come up as you walk. It should move freely. That's what I tell people when, as soon as they come in, you know, you just want it to fit snug across the top of your foot, like a glove.
Mm-hmm.
As long as your toes are comfortable, you know, your toes come up into the toe box like right about there.
Right, so there's an inch of boot left.
Other than that, it's just a matter of finding what
kind
is most comfortable.
So, where do I start?
Go ahead and slip it on. We'll see how it goes.
And see if it really fits.
Most people go down about a half size to
you.
So, if you wear like an 8-inch in a shoe, and you want it to be tough. You want it to be tough to get on.
Okay, I bought them. Old Gringos, black with green and red stitching. On sale, I might add. But what I gained in footwear, I lost in eyewear. My sunglasses disappeared. They turned up 3 days later in a boot. A common occurrence, says Greenberg. A lot of cell phones and wallets are accidentally dropped in boots every week. There used to be a time when the day's proceeds were put into a different boot every night at closing time, but owner Steve Greenberg said it became too difficult to remember which boot the money was in. You can see a short slideshow on how to get fitted for a cowboy boot at our website, npr.org.
It's going to take a lot of good news to combat the effects of a recession that wiped out more than 8 million American jobs. Still, a new batch of economic reports out this week look pretty good. The economy appears to have stopped shedding jobs. Employers created jobs last month at the fastest pace in 3 years, although it was not enough to change the unemployment numbers. The economy is growing, but not at the faster rate we saw earlier in the year. Manufacturing jobs are still hard to find, but productivity is way up. Today, we're going to try to sort out what all this news means for the nation's recovery. I'm joined by Michael Mandel. He's the chief economist at Visible Economy, LLC, and he joins us from our New York bureau. Welcome to the program.
Great to be here, Linda.
So could you just break this down a little bit? What do you see on the good side of the economic recovery ledger and what do you see on the bad side? Let's start with the good news.
The good news, of course, is that the number of jobs in the private sector is finally increasing. Now, as you say, not by an enormous amount, but there's a big difference between falling and growing. The private sector added 123,000 jobs in March, which is not an enormous number, but it's not negative. The second thing is that the housing market appears to have bottomed out across the country. Some places prices are rising, some places prices are falling, but we're no longer heading down off the cliff. And the third piece of good news is that the financial sector seems to be finally knitting itself back together again. And if we look around the economy, one of the things that I look at is I look at the signs of industries that are actually have been adding jobs for a while, even though the rest of the economy has been weak. And what I see is there's been jobs that have been added in internet publishing, in web search, in wireless telecom, in computer systems programming. In some sense, the new communication sector of the economy actually seems to have some mojo in it.
And the jobs question. I mean, 8 million people lost their jobs. 123,000 jobs when you put it up against 8 million jobs lost in the recession. It's not much.
Well, you didn't ask me get to the bad stuff, so
okay.
Let me get to the bad stuff.
All right, let's do the bad stuff.
First is enormous debts on the state and local level. So we're going to have a lot of job layoffs to come yet on the state and local level. The second thing is that there's a lot of debt floating around still in the private sector in terms of people with big mortgages, people with big credit card debts, and that's going to sort of impair growth for a long time to come. And the third thing, which I think is really big, is that we're still running a humongous trade deficit, even after all these cutbacks, even after people have pulled in their belts. And what that means is that we're still borrowing. The U.S. is still borrowing enormous sums from the rest of the world, which means that, you know, there's probably another crisis coming down the road, maybe not next week, maybe not next month, but a little bit further out.
The president was in North Carolina yesterday, Michael Mandel, and he said that the economy seems to have turned the corner. Do you think that's right?
I think we've bounced off the bottom. What I'm seeing at this point is a two-track economy where most of the economy is going to sort of bounce along the bottom for a while, dragged down by debt, dragged down by the state and local government, and that there may be sectors, including communications and maybe other sectors too, that actually get some strength, some hiring, some growth to it. So I don't see us at the beginning yet of a sustained strong recovery, but we have turned the corner from sliding down to maybe bouncing up a bit.
What do you think the president's major project of the last few months, the health care bill, is that going to make any kind of an economic difference as it goes into effect?
Well, yeah, the fact is that health care sector has been a tremendous producer of jobs, not just now, but over the last 10 years, really. If you look at the entire boom from 2000 to 2007, basically about three quarters of new private sector jobs came out of healthcare and education. Just an amazing number. And the healthcare sector has continued to produce jobs even during the downturn. So that's actually nothing new. We're going to be putting more money in. That will keep the job growth going. But frankly, an economy which is built purely on healthcare jobs is not going to be a good competitive economy. We need to produce jobs elsewhere. And right at this point, the only place that those are going to come from is from new and innovative industries. And I'd like to see more support on that coming out of Washington.
Michael Mandel is chief economist at Visible Economy, LLC. He joined us from our New York bureau. Michael Mandel, thank you.
Thank you.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. Guy Raz is away. I'm Linda Wertheimer. President Obama made a surprise visit to Afghanistan last weekend to see the troops, but the other order of business during his six-hour touchdown was a fairly tense conversation with the country's president, Hamid Karzai, about political corruption and cronyism. Karzai began his second term last fall under widespread allegations of voter fraud. Since then, he seized control of the watchdog group that nullified more than 1 million fraudulent votes. On Thursday, Karzai made a fiery speech railing against the West and the UN, saying foreigners want to install a puppet government, that they were responsible for rigging the election.
There was fraud in the presidential and provincial election. With no doubt, there was massive fraud. This wasn't fraud by Afghans, but the fraud of foreigners.
The Obama administration called Karzai's speech genuinely troubling, saying the White House would seek clarification. Then on Friday, The Afghan leader called Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, wondering why U.S. officials seemed upset. To help us with the question, what to do about Karzai, I'm joined by Jean McKenzie. She's the Afghanistan correspondent for the Global Post. Jean McKenzie, welcome.
Thank you, Linda.
This has been quite a week for President Karzai.
Yes, it has.
What do you think all this means?
Well, Hamid Karzai is the artful dodger of international politics, and I think we've seen that very well this week. This has been his pattern for many years. His speech on Thursday was obviously geared towards the domestic audience, where anti-Americanism and anti-Westernism plays very well. He's exploiting attitudes and fears, prejudices among his constituency to shore up his own political power at home, and then being conciliatory with his international partners in a different forum.
One of the things that apparently he and President Obama had an unhappy conversation about was the number of relatives that he has appointed to the government and the efforts that he has made to sort of shield the warlords in Afghanistan from any repercussions for anything that they've done.
That is true. But to give him his due, he's in a very difficult position. Many of those warlords and many, indeed, of his relatives are in close cooperation with the West and with the United States of America. So on the one hand, we are hammering Karzai for corruption. On the other hand, it is some of our own actions and policies that are keeping those people in power.
To some extent, it works for us, I guess. What about the reaction here, though, and among other countries that are contributing troops to the effort in Afghanistan? There were some comments after his speech in which he said there's a sort of a thin curtain between invasion and assistance. There's people sort of raising questions of why are we doing this?
And I think that's a very legitimate question. But we also have to realize that in terms of international commitment to Afghanistan, it's very definitely on the wane. Canada will be out by the middle of next year. The Netherlands is on its way out. There is a growing movement in the United Kingdom to get out of Afghanistan. I think in some cases we are seeing the international community seizing on these statements and these actions of Karzai as a way of justifying what their policies are going towards anyway, which is getting out of Afghanistan as soon as possible.
But for the United States, do you think that the United States' national security reasons for being in Afghanistan in the first instance are still relevant? Does the United States still have a major interest in staying?
I'm not sure that national security is our primary reason for being in Afghanistan, nor was it ever our primary reason for being in Afghanistan. Our national security concerns are quite small. We have broad agreement that al-Qaeda is no longer a major player in Afghanistan, and we are fighting a war against the Taliban, who were not the primary movers behind 9/11. What we have is a very big political reason for being in Afghanistan. We went in there under the guise of the war on terror, but moved into nation building. Our mission has become very foggy there.
Where do you see this going?
That's the million-dollar question, or the several billion-dollar question, I guess, from the American perspective. Hamid Karzai is the president of a small, poor, very dysfunctional country who seems to have run rings around the largest economy in the world. We cannot afford to let Hamid Karzai fail. We cannot afford to let Afghanistan fail.
Why not?
Because then we would have to admit that the past 8.5 years have been an exercise in futility. If Afghanistan can fail with no adverse consequences to the United States, then what have we been doing for 8.5 years? I think that is the political consideration. We want to get out of Afghanistan. I think that's clear. But we want to get out of Afghanistan with some sort of semblance of victory or at least achievement under our belt.
Jean McKenzie is the Afghanistan correspondent for the Global Post. Thank you very much for your help.
My pleasure, Linda.
If you're fortunate enough to have a bit of land to till, you may be planting a garden by now. This spring, even urban dwellers with no access to soil are getting into the game with hydroponic gardening. In New York City, two young women are promoting what they call window farms. John Kalish has the story.
33-year-old Britta Riley has advised museums on public participation and is well-versed in social media. So last year, she was able to raise $27,000 for her Window Farms project through an online micro-donation website. Riley says she and her partner in the window farming project are do-it-yourselfers.
I grew up on a ranch in Texas, and so we had to always just hack together what we needed to fix fences and so forth. And my partner on the project, she's a gardener, so she's been finding ways of making it work for a long time.
Riley's partner is Maya Nyack, a professional gardener who's 29. She's been growing herbs in her window farm at home, which is on the ground floor of an apartment building. There's a sign in her window that says windowfarms.org, and a lot of parents with kids in tow have stopped by to check it out.
We had to put up a curtain because people come up and look, and then you're like, wow, this is my living room, and there's people staring.
What is that?
What it is can best be described as vertical columns of plants hanging in front of your window. There's not a drop of soil, but vegetables and herbs grow with the help of sunlight and a little electricity. You can download instructions from the Window Farms website on how to put together a system that grows three plants. The materials will cost about $30. Much of the stuff you'll need is not usually associated with gardening.
Water bottles, an aquarium air pump that you get at a pet store, air valve needles that are used to pump up a basketball with a bike pump, a hanging system that's meant for hanging art.
Britta Riley says recycling consumer goods is an important part of the DIY ethic.
We're kind of showing that we can actually get really, really far using things that we already have available to us as consumers.
Riley lives in a loft in Brooklyn, which is also home to the Window Farms lab. The day I dropped by, three people were installing a new Window Farm system on a wall above a south-facing window. Basically, the least complicated of the window farm systems is a column of upside-down spring water bottles connected to each other with plants growing out of holes cut in the sides. An air pump is used to circulate liquid nutrients that then trickle down the top of the column and make their way to the plant roots.
Britta's favorite vegetable is bok choy. And whenever anyone asks her, they're like, what grows better in a window farm? She's like, well, I just love bok choy.
Window farms have been used to grow strawberries, cherry tomatoes, and peppers. Window farmer Maya Nyack.
Buttercrunch lettuce grows great, and lots of herbs. Anything leafy and green, essentially. You can't grow carrots. I mean, you can't grow root vegetables. Potatoes, garlic, those things don't work.
Close to 4,000 people have registered at the Window Farms website, and people have built window farms across this country and in Italy, Israel, Hong Kong, and Finland. These urban farmers use the internet to exchange ideas for improving the window farm's technology. It's a process Riley calls R&DIY, or research and develop it yourself. One window farmer figured out how to cope with the gurgling sound these window farm systems make.
He just drilled a few holes into a vitamin bottle and stuck it over the end, and all of a sudden it completely silenced the system. And then he posted that for everybody else, and all of a sudden we have a new solution that's cheap and that other people can replicate somewhere else.
In the coming months, Riley and her colleagues will focus on how much energy it takes to run the air pumps and the compact fluorescent light bulbs used when access to sunlight is a problem. Riley says that in addition to the environmental benefits of growing your own food at home, there are aesthetic ones.
It's just fun to have food growing in your own apartment, and especially during the winter months, you've got this like lush green bunch of lettuce growing in your window that's kind of freshening the air in your apartment, and it actually just looks pretty.
Britta Riley has noticed that some people who are interested in trying a window farm are not really into building it themselves. So this month, her group will start selling window farm kits. For NPR News, I'm John Kalish in New York.
Mm-hmm. You can see what window farms look like and learn how to build one yourself at our website, npr.org. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News, directed by Thomas Pierce and produced by Elaine Heinzman, Gemma Waters, Kimberly Adams, Veronica Miller, Eamon Malone, Jonathan Rappaport, and Sarah Coe. Our technical director is Burke Hunn. Melissa Goh is our web producer. Our librarian is Key Purple Peeps Molesky. Our show was edited by Jeffrey Bennett and produced today by Sarah Beyer Kelly. Jenny Bergall is our senior supervising editor, and the senior supervising producer of Weekend Edition is Bridget Kelly. I'm Leanne Hansen.